And serves on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit, to which he was appointed in 2018 by President Donald J. Trump. Judge Brennan is a graduate of the University of Notre Dame Law School, Notre Dame undergraduate, Northwestern University Law School. He served as a law clerk on the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Wisconsin, where he clerked for Judge Robert Warren, and on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit, where he clerked for Judge Mannion. Before joining the Seventh Circuit, he did quite a few different things, including serving as a judge in the Milwaukee area, where he presided over criminal and civil cases. He was an assistant DA. He was involved in private practice. And so please join me in welcoming Judge Brennan, who's going to kick us off for a terrific discussion.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Sam. Our topic today is that notable and sometimes treacherous intersection of the separation of powers. When an Article II nomination moves to Section 3 of Article 1 for advice and consent, and sometimes a lifetime Article III judge is the result. Presidents and senates have differed greatly in their approaches to these constitutional duties. For President Andrew Jackson, it was to the victor go the spoils. President Lincoln's approach was fairness to all. In a fireside chat, President Franklin Roosevelt described the American government as a three-horse team that had to pull together in unison. To FDR, the court had set itself up as a super legislature, and the time had come, he thought, to save the Constitution from the court and the court from itself. For President Ronald Reagan, the errors were not with the framers, but with those who have looked upon the courts as a province to impose by judicial fiat what could not be accomplished at the polls. To better understand this path through these separate and independent branches, we'll receive the benefit of the knowledge and experience of four excellent panelists. I'm going to introduce them in the order in which they'll give their opening remarks. Rob Luther is a distinguished professor of law at Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason University and the founder of Constitutional Solutions, PLLC. He teaches and writes in the federal courts, legal and judicial ethics, and political law. Rob served as associate White House counsel in the first Trump administration, where his principal responsibility was co-managing the White House's judicial selection process. Rob supervised the preparation of over 150 federal judicial nominees for their successful U.S. Senate confirmation hearings. Rob clerked for the late Judge Daniel Mannion of the United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit. Mike Fragoso is chief counsel to Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. Mike previously served as chief counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, working for Senators Chuck Grassley and Senator Lindsey Graham, and as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Legal Policy of the U.S. Department of Justice. Mike clerked for the Honorable Diane Sykes, Chief Judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit. Carl Tobias holds the Williams Chair in Law at the University of Richmond School of Law. He teaches and writes in a number of areas with a particular focus on the federal judicial selection process. Professor Tobias has authored over 120 law review articles and more than 80 essays in the country's top law journals, as well as hundreds of opinion pieces published throughout the country. By any measure, Professor Tobias is the leading commentator on the federal judicial nomination and selection process. If you've read an article on this topic, you've probably seen Professor Tobias quoted. David Latt is a lawyer, author, novelist, and legal commentator. He has worked in big law as a federal prosecutor, a blogger with Underneath Their Robes, and he was the founder of Above the Law, a website about law firms and the legal profession. Undoubtedly, you now read David's work on his Substack newsletter, Original Jurisdiction, because everyone reads Original Jurisdiction. David clerked for the Honorable Diarmuid O'Scanlan of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. Quick word on format. This session could easily span 3 hours. We have 90 minutes. Each of our panelists will give a thesis statement for 8 to 9 minutes. I'm then going to ask the panelists to respond to each other's remarks. And after we move through at least one round of responses, we'll open up the discussion for any other comments from the speakers, followed by questions from the audience. So we'll now hear from our panelists, starting with Professor Luther.
Thanks to Judge Brennan for that introduction, to the Federalist Society for having me, and for my co-panelists for participating in this discussion. I'm going to talk about the judicial nominations landscape as I see it today from the perspective of the former White House lawyer responsible for judicial nominations. I think the first thing I want to do is define for everyone what doing judges or picking judges actually looks like. For starters, I can tell you what it is not. It is not sitting in a room deciding who you want to put on the bench. That's the fun part, but it's a very small part of the process. Thinking that the job is just coming up with names and vetting people is simply the wrong way to conceptualize it because that's purely reactive. Directing judicial strategy, however, is a highly proactive 12-step process. Like litigation, if you want to win, you have to be aggressive. First, you must preserve the existing vacancies that the president before you left behind. Then you must come up with some names. Then you run the informal background check on the names. Then you conduct the interviews. Then you approach the senators and begin negotiations. Then you brief the president. Then you run formal background checks. Then you brief the senators on the result of those background checks. Then the president nominates a candidate. Then you prepare a candidate for a confirmation hearing. Then you deal with the media that is trying to kill your nominee. Then you make sure your nominee is confirmed. So about that first step of preserving existing vacancies. As we sit here up on Capitol Hill, there are 28 nominees pending in the Democrat-controlled Senate that are ripe for confirmation. Five of them include circuit judges and two for the DDC. The Democrats currently have a one-vote advantage in the Senate, but on Sunday night, President-elect Trump said that no more judges should be confirmed. Still, two district judges were confirmed this week. I understand that recently elected Majority Leader John Thune is putting pressure on his Republican colleagues to show up and vote against these nominees. With a one-vote advantage and Senator Manchin confirming on Tuesday that he won't vote for any nominees without one Republican vote, anything can happen. Many or all of them may still be confirmed, but if the Senate doesn't focus on this, all of them will be. Moving into post-inauguration judicial strategy, you'd be crazy to think that losing almost 30 seats in the lame duck isn't a big deal. If you had, say, hundreds of vacancies awaiting you during the term, maybe you could convince yourself it wasn't the end of the world. But President Trump isn't going to have anywhere near the vacancies we had in 2017. We had 108 vacancies on day one, including Justice Scalia's seat. We had 17 circuit vacancies. I've studied the data, and realistically, that 108 number that we had in 2017 is probably pretty close to the number of nominations President Trump will be able to make over the entirety of his term if the Republicans keep the Senate. Maybe a few more, maybe 120 in total. So to recap, President Trump appointed 234 judges. He could return to office with around 30 vacancies and only one circuit seat in Delaware for a judge who's going senior on January 15th, and then a New Jersey seat where the pending nominee may not be confirmed. The numbers are going to continue to shrink by the day. Democrat appointees who had sent President Biden conditional retirement letters are already withdrawing them. It happened on the district court in Ohio just a few days ago, and I expect it to happen a few more times before January 20th if these folks aren't confirmed. But won't more Republican appointees retire after President Trump is inaugurated, you ask? There will be some. There will be 38 retirement-eligible circuit judges on day one of the new term. 26 are Republican appointees, 12 are Democrat appointees. But only 6 of the 26 Republicans have become senior eligible since Trump's first term. Some of the others have been eligible to retire since the 1990s. The point is that of these 38 likely to retire, the number likely to do so at the outset of Trump's term is fairly small. I would say maybe 6, so a third of what we had on day one. There will be 61 retirement-eligible circuit judges during the entirety of Trump's term, but there were about 100 retirement-eligible circuit judges on day one in 2017. As you know, we actually secured 54 circuit confirmations, so if you take 54 out of 100, that gives you 54%. If Trump secures 54% of the 61 retirement-eligible circuit judges, then he'll get 33 over his four-year term, assuming Republicans keep the Senate in 26. If they don't, obviously this number will fall off a cliff. You know what's funny about this number 33? It's exactly the number of circuit judges who are Republicans who are eligible to retire over the entirety of Trump's term. So what happens when you only have about 8 circuit confirmations a year? Brings back memories of the Bush administration, 62 circuit judges over 8 years. Those aren't happy memories. Every circuit confirmation was like a mini Supreme Court battle. So with so few circuit vacancies forthcoming in January, focus is likely to turn to the district courts because there's, well, way more of them. But we know that the White House has the thumb on the scales for circuit judges, and senators have their thumb on the scale for the district courts. Senator Chuck Grassley will return as chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee. This is a good thing. Recall that it was under his leadership in 2017 that we abandoned the blue slip requirement for circuit judges. That was absolutely the right decision to move forward, absolutely the right decision by the chairman, and his leadership in that respect permitted President Trump to move forward with some of the best circuit judges of his term, including our moderator, Judge Brennan, David Strauss of the Eighth Circuit, Steve Menasche of the Second Circuit, and our four horsemen of California, Ninth Circuit judges Dan Collins, Dan Bress, Patrick Bumate, and Ken Lee. Those names are all well known to you. Imagine if President Trump could put 90 more of his nominees of his choosing on the district court. Imagine what things might look like with conservatives on the bench in Boston, New York City, or San Francisco. I think the biggest open question for federal judicial selection in the next administration is the extent to which Chairman Grassley will uphold the senatorial blue slip veto for district court nominees. Now, Trump has firsthand experience over the last few years dealing with good district judges and bad district judges. My sense from Trump world is that there's an appetite to take a more aggressive stance with respect to senatorial recommendations on district court nominees. Trump has already solidified his legacy on the Supreme Court and the courts of appeals. If he truly wants to remake the federal judiciary in his image, he needs to make more of an impact on the district courts. So I urge him to leverage the power of his office to work with Chairman Grassley to make that happen by loosening the absolute veto home state senators have on district court nominees. So how is this going to happen? White House counsel Bill McGinley is going to need a skilled negotiator who understands the specific senators' need from these nominees coming out of their states. This is retail politics. You have to invest the time in every nominee because every situation is unique. Senators are like common law judges. There are few rules but many precedents. The deals you get in states with one Democratic senator are different than the rules you get in states with two. And even then, the ratios are different depending on past precedent. Sometimes it's 1-for-1, sometimes it's 2-for-1. I've written a number of articles on this, but going through all of it would take a book. It's just too much to learn on the fly, and, well, you're playing with dynamite. And don't forget that while senators care about judges, they also care about U.S. attorneys and marshals, too. I'll close by addressing this question that I've been asked a lot. Will the president be looking for different nominees this term compared to 2017? For the most part, I think this is a solution in search of a problem. This group hardly needs the reminder that judicial nominations were the most successful policy initiative of President Trump's first term. But I don't see a lot of wisdom in revisiting that process. There's no need to start focusing on fortitude. We already did that the first time because we knew that the media and the left wing of the profession would move to undermine our nominees. That's why we asked the president to nominate people with the kind of fortitude we've seen in the opinions of Greg Katsas, Lisa Branch, Kyle Duncan, Andy Oldham, John Nalbandian, Kat Mizell, and Eileen Cannon. Change is necessary, but not in the White House, in the Senate. It is my understanding that over the next 4 years, there's going to be an even greater emphasis on whether judicial candidates have bled on the battlefield of the conservative legal movement. Candidates who have just been plodding along in private practice or government without ever facing public criticism are likely to be rejected by the White House. If that is a litmus test, so be it. During the first term, I used to ask nominees to tell us about a time in their personal or professional life where they stood for principle and paid the price. In the same vein, moving forward, I think candidates should be asked, what have you done to prove that you share President Trump's worldview and judicial philosophy? For example, such a question might be, do you believe that immigration laws should be fully enforced, notwithstanding public sentiment? This is nothing new. This is not a loyalty oath. Judicial candidates throughout history have more frequently than not had some connection to the president that nominated him or their party, and the president has the right to know what he's getting when he decides to invest his political capital into a nominee. I expect to see more of this time, and I'm fully on board with it. Now is a good time to take stock of where we were when Trump was elected the first time 8 years ago. Some of you questioned his commitment to the courts, but look what he has given us. 3 justices that overruled Roe, overruled Chevron, and overruled affirmative action in schools. Dozens of great judges, many of whom are in the room today. Thousands of federal clerkships. and countless of opportunities for people in the movement to serve our country to make it a better place for the rule of law. And there's more coming. So for that, I'm very grateful. We must not forget and we must not overlook that while Trump did all this for the rule of law, government agents, lawyers, prosecutors, and judges failed him at every turn. And for that, I'm very disappointed, and it cannot happen again. Thank you.
Thank you, Rob. Mike Fragoso.
Well, the more things change, the more they stay the same. We're here to discuss judicial appointments in the Trump administration. I would start with the record of the previous Trump administration, when he and Leader McConnell saw the appointment of 234 Article III judges, including three to the Supreme Court. This achievement was possible because we had a White House that prioritized nominating qualified judges and a Senate that was eager to do the work to confirm them. Rob can speak more to the former aspect, and he just did, while I can speak to the latter. The Senate confirmed so many judges because of Mitch McConnell. Judges have always been important to the Senate, but before the McConnell era, they were sort of one issue among many. It was not uncommon for judges to be part of the standard log rolling of legislation, take a judge hostage here for a policy there, dutifully accept bar cronies as the price of doing business with this important senator, prioritize messaging bills on the floor instead of judicial confirmations, and so on. Not on McConnell's watch. He has often said that the most important power of the majority leader is to decide the Senate agenda, and that is what he did, enthusiastically exercising that privilege to benefit the judiciary. It could be because he was a young staffer when Judge Haynsworth and Carswell went down in flames during the Nixon administration, or perhaps because of his own foray into federal court to challenge the obviously unconstitutional bipartisan Campaign Finance Reform Act, McCain-Feingold, but McConnell has understood the singular importance of judges. That's why he held the Scalia seat open, and that's why he made it clear to the White House and the Republican Conference that judges would be a priority for the Republican Senate during the first Trump administration. That's why as soon as the 115th Congress began, he started a successful education project with his members to explain the archaism of the Circuit Court blue slip, knowing full well that its exercise would stymie the new president. That's why, in the face of unprecedented Democrat obstruction of his district court, of the president's district court nominees, he undertook a similar education project reforming post-cloture time. A result of this focused effort, he was able to help the president in putting up these record numbers. Now, there's a conventional wisdom about these Trump-McConnell judges that they were, by and large, young, conservative, and well-credentialed. I think this is true. My old boss at DOJ, Beth Williams, wrote an excellent article on just how well-credentialed they were. 41% of the Trump-McConnell circuit judges clerked at the Supreme Court, and 81% clerked at the circuit court. Almost 60% graduated with high honors, and almost 70% were on law review. But an underappreciated aspect of the Trump-McConnell judges is how important their legal talent was to getting them confirmed. For example, for the Scalia seat, McConnell anticipated a Democrat filibuster, and he told President Trump to send, quote, the best qualified conservative pick that he could find, because McConnell knew that he would need a nominee so beyond reproach that he could tell reluctant senators, in effect, if they'll filibuster this guy, we can't do anyone. And so we got Judge Dr. Neil Gorsuch, DPhil, Oxoniensis. Similar dynamics persisted over time in the lower courts. For the first 2 years of President Trump, we often had a 51-49 or even 50-49 Senate, which included Senators McCain, Flake, and Corker, just to pick a few who were not always interested in simply voting along to get along. Although we expanded our majority in the next Congress, it didn't mean that we had a rubber stamp in the Republican Conference. Necessary members wanted to know that these were good picks, and it fell to McConnell, Grassley, Graham, Cornyn, and Thune and their staffs to convince them. This is why McConnell told Don McGahn this time 8 years ago, quote, Don, just send up the best conservative nominees you can and as quickly as you can, and Chuck Grassley and I will take care of the rest. Taking care of it took work. As I explained recently in the Harvard Journal of Law and Public Policy, in a post-nuclear age of judicial confirmations, the biggest threat to confirmation is intra-party defection. That is always on top of mind for Republicans, or at least it ought to be. Here a minute on terminology could be helpful. An effective shibboleth to tell whether a commentator knows what he's talking about when it comes to the Senate is whether or not he refers to the Republican caucus. If he does, he probably doesn't. The rule of thumb is that Democrats have a caucus, Republicans have a conference. And it's not just a matter of semantic preference. Caucuses purport to bind their members, a reality reflected by the sweeping powers held by the Democrat leader. For example, Leader Schumer assigns all open committee slots himself personally. He personally picks the chair of their senatorial committee. He presides over every one of their conference meetings and lunches. During the Wilson administration, the Democrats even enacted the so-called Blackburn Rule, proposed by Kentucky Senator J.C.S. Blackburn, in which all their caucuses could be bound to support most matters that had two-thirds support within their caucus. Republicans never enacted a Blackburn Rule, and at that time started to call themselves a conference. While the conference does have formal rules, those rules still provide considerable power to individual members against their elected leadership. As a result, independent-minded Republican senators, both on the right and in the middle, have considerable leeway to continue to be, well, independent-minded. This is simply a legislative reality that needs to be managed, and one that McConnell and his allies managed very actively when it comes to judges. Again, intraparty defection is the main threat to a nominee, and Republican principles of member independence make that threat pretty omnipresent. But we learned during the Trump administration that the best way to avoid intraparty defection on judges is to pick talented judicial nominees, whose only controversy is their commitment to the Constitution. Biden's record has been rather different. To his credit, he posted very impressive numbers. He currently stands at 213 and could add up to 24 more depending on the results of the lame duck. Of course, as Rob has pointed out in articles in the past, most of those were liberals replacing liberals, and so there wasn't the kind of real reversal and jurisprudential sea change that we saw under Trump and McConnell from a Supreme Court that's now supermajority originalist to a Ninth Circuit that's at near parity. Biden also had a laser-like focus on racial and professional diversity on the bench generally, favoring African-American women and public defenders in numbers pretty disproportionate to their respective shares of the legal profession, ostensibly to boost their representation in the judiciary as a whole. In noted contrast to Trump, for whatever reason, he seems to generally eschew Supreme Court clerks, although clerks of far-left circuit judges have been pretty well represented. Well, the Trump-McConnell judges have been on the bench for up to 8 years, while the Biden-Schumer judges have been on the bench for nearly four. How do they compare? Professors recently at NYU and UVA studied it using some quantitative methods, which, you know, you have to take them with a grain of salt, but they were interesting in that they found the most productive, influential, and independent judges in the country were almost all Trump-McConnell judges. A couple of Obama judges and a W. Bush judge or two sometimes snuck in, but it was the Trump-McConnells who stole the show, including some of those who the media consider the most controversial. This surprised none of us who have been paying attention. As noted above, the Trump-McConnell judges tended towards superlative credentials, prestigious clerkships, top law school performance, competitive early employment. Their professional backgrounds also tended to be restricted to highly competitive fields. While the Trump-McConnell judges were actually quite biographically diverse in interesting ways, Trump probably appointed more Asian circuit judges than all his predecessors combined to the circuit court. He appointed multiple Jewish Hispanics. He appointed ordained clergy from three different faiths. He put the first mother of school-age children on the Supreme Court. But I think it's their professional backgrounds that drive their effectiveness. If you're a big law partner, the busiest federal circuit is a vacation by comparison. If you're a red state solicitor general, you know there are five other Clarence Thomas clerks waiting in the shadows to replace you if you drop the ball. If you work in the Trump administration, every day is gladiator combat against Democrats, liberal nonprofits, big tech, and the deep state. The result was candidates that were picked from parts of the legal profession where attorneys were trained to work hard and work smart. They're judicial Fremen, or judicial Sardaukar, if you're on the left. But this is all the past. The Trump-McConnell pipeline is no more. But I have every confidence now that Senator Thune will be majority leader in January, he will follow in McConnell's footsteps and find an eager partner in the returned President Trump. Of course, as Rob noted, because Trump and Biden filled so many vacancies, this next administration will probably have fewer to contend with, which may not be a bad thing for other necessary legislative priorities. But from a Senate perspective, I think we should expect Thune and his conference to give judges the same level of priority that McConnell did for the earlier Trump Congresses. And as with before, I don't think we should expect prioritizing judges will be a rubber stamp. I suspect a number of members will demand similar levels of excellence that we saw in the last Trump administration. Intra-party defection remains the main threat to confirmation, and legal talent remains the best way to preempt it. The jury, so to speak, is also back that the traditional indicia of legal talent corresponds strongly to judicial productivity and influence. To quote the late Justice Scalia, you can't make a sow's ear out of a silk purse. The outgoing president apparently liked to be compared to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, a conceit that seems to have led his party to electoral ruin. But if the incoming administration follows the practice of the first Trump term and continues to select outstanding judicial nominees in close coordination with Senate leadership, President Trump will easily have the greatest effect on the judiciary since FDR. I hope he does.
Thank you, Mike. Professor Tobias.
Thank you, Judge, and thank you for moderating. Thanks to the Federalist Society for inviting me. Thanks to my co-panelists. I agree with a lot that was just said, and I imagine David will too. And I'll try not to be redundant. But my starting point would be the lame duck session right now. And just to point out, on Sunday, I believe President-elect Trump said to GOP senators that he wanted them to not allow any of the nominees to be confirmed. That didn't happen. In fact, two Illinois district judges were confirmed. Embry Kidd, the nominee for the 11th Circuit, I believe, will have a cloture vote today or soon. And this morning, just to bring things up to date, in the Senate Judiciary Committee, Ryan Park, a well-qualified nominee for the 4th Circuit from North Carolina, had an 11-10 party line vote. That led Senator Tillis, the home state senator, to say essentially that he was no longer going to be bipartisan, which is unfortunate because he has been bipartisan in committee, and I think that's been valuable, as has Lindsey Graham, the ranking member. And Graham has said, of course, that it's important to keep the blue slip, for example, with district judges, and he believes that elections have consequences, and so he has voted for a number of President Biden's nominees in committee and on the floor. So there is a fair amount of bipartisanship, and I was distressed to see that Senator Tillis would not continue to talk about that, which I think is very important. In fact, he was so frustrated that the White House had not consulted him on the Park nomination, which I think is not exactly what happened. But in any event, Park was nominated and has gone through committee and is likely to be confirmed, as are most of the district nominees who have had votes out of committee and are on the floor awaiting votes. So I think that's the way it looks. And what that means, of course, as people have already suggested, is there won't be very many vacancies at the outset of the administration. Perhaps only a handful in the appellate courts, and then probably 25 or 30 in the district courts. And I agree with what a number of people have said, that there are many eligible people who have met the requirements, the rule of 80, 65 years old and 15 years of service, who could assume senior status. So it could increase quite substantially over the time of the administration. So I think that's what we're likely to see. So to finish out, I think, in at least in the lame duck, in the near term, we're likely to see four or five appellate nominees confirmed, probably 20 or so district nominees confirmed. Some of the votes may be quite close, and we'll just have to see. If there's not enough time, Democrats may choose to do what President Trump did, and Democrats have done before, have a voterama on the district nominees who only need 2 hours of debate time. So I just want to add to that, which has already been said about diversity, and I don't want to steal the thunder from my colleague, David Latt. But I would say that in terms of experiential diversity, that the Biden administration has made unprecedented appointments, especially people who are former criminal defense counsel, but others as well, and that has been helpful. One other thing I want to talk about is to think about what we can do to improve the federal courts. And many of you know that there was a judgeships bill that received unanimous consent in the Senate and was sent to the House. And I think that would be valuable. It's mostly district judges. It spreads them out, I think, over three presidencies. And I think the federal courts need more resources to do what they are asked to do. And that is, under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 1, to provide fair and expeditious and inexpensive resolution of disputes. And so I think this judgeships bill would go a long way towards that and maybe even promote more bipartisan appointments. So I'm cautiously optimistic the House may do something with that, but we'll have to see. But it's rare that you could have that kind of unanimity in the U.S. Senate, and it's important to move forward on that front.
Thank you, Professor. David Latt.
Dean, thanks so much for having me. It is really great to be here, and I guess I'm not surprised to see a standing room only crowd. This is a topic of great interest. I would point out that, as noted in, as you can tell from the title of this panel, we planned it before we knew the election results, so this could have been crickets, but instead we have a standing room only crowd. And I think, why are some of you here? Well, some of you are already judges, so you're good. But I think that this panel could otherwise be titled, "So You Want to Become a Federal Judge." In years past, I would say, this version of the panel at the Federalist Society would offer you some helpful guidance in terms of making your way to the bench. I'm not so sure now. One thing I would point out is, this time around, despite some suggestions, including in an interview with either the Washington Examiner or the Washington Times, that he would offer us yet another Supreme Court shortlist, or shortlists, as he has done in the past, candidate Trump did not provide us with the names of potential Supreme Court nominees. So that is interesting. In some ways, I think he's trying to reserve some of the discretion he might have to make some unpredictable appointments. And I think it's unclear how much influence the Federalist Society will have over his judicial nominations in a second Trump administration. And by the way, just to clarify, because I know FedSoc is really big on this, when I speak of the Federalist Society, I'm speaking of it in terms of what Hillary Clinton memorably described as the vast right-wing conspiracy. I'm speaking of FedSoc as a movement, as a network, et cetera. I know that the Federalist Society itself as an organization is a 501c3, and it doesn't take political stances. And Leonard Leo, when he got involved in advising Trump, officially stepped down from his position as executive vice president. So FedSoc staffers in the room, duly noted. You're not going to lose your status. But when I talk about FedSoc as a movement, that's what I'm referring to, and I do wonder how much influence it will have. I do think that one thing that we can predict about the second Trump administration is it is going to be unpredictable. take this week's cabinet appointments. As Senator Lisa Murkowski said about Matt Gaetz, he was not on anyone's bingo card. So there are definitely some surprises here. And look, I should say, I think my fellow panelists on this stage are some of the most knowledgeable people around. And we have people, of course, like Rob, who was in the White House, and Mike, who's on Capitol Hill. So really, you couldn't find better experts on this topic. But again, when it comes to the Trump administration, I guess Judge Brennan promised you that we would have thesis statements. Here's my thesis statement, and I'm going to quote what screenwriter William Goldman famously said about Hollywood. When it comes to the Trump administration, nobody knows anything. I think there are going to be a lot of surprises, maybe some surprises people like, maybe some surprises people don't like, but I don't think it is going to be as predictable as the first administration when former White House counsel Don McGahn memorably quipped that Trump had not only outsourced judicial nominations to the Federalist Society, it was better to say he had insourced them. I think it's going to be a very different landscape. So keeping with my thesis of uncertainty, I'm actually going to float or pose a number of questions rather than a number of predictions. And I'll give some preliminary thoughts on my answers to the questions, but I really do think these are open questions. First, as I mentioned earlier, how much of a role will the Federalist Society play? And it has been reported in various outlets, whether you trust them or not, I know that maybe this group doesn't love the mainstream media, but the Times and the Post have reported, for example, that President Trump and Leonard Leo, for example, are no longer, shall we say, as tight as they once were. And so I do think that there is that kind of ambiguity over how much of a role the Federalist Society will play. But I will say this to make some of you in the room feel a little better. I think that the Federalist Society, to its credit, has spread so widely within the circles of conservative and libertarian lawyers that it would be essentially, I think, impossible to really shut out FedSoc-affiliated people entirely. Even if we have a lower number of vacancies, and I agree with all the panelists, we will, there are just too many highly qualified lawyers and judges who belong to or are otherwise connected with the Federalist Society for the Trump administration to, in a fit of pique, say, well, we're not going to pick any FedSoc nominees for judgeships because a couple of FedSoc judges disappointed Trump, for example, by ruling against his 2020 election challenges. And I would also point out, remember, the Senate is definitely going to be very compliant with President Trump, which is why I'm a little puzzled by what you may have seen in the news about this talk of recess appointments. Why does he need this? I think the Senate is going to be very, very accommodating. But I will say this. The Senate still does perform a certain check. I think that check will be heightened when it comes to Supreme Court nominees. And so I do think that when it comes to Supreme Court nominees, we are going to see nominees, assuming Trump does get vacancies, that will look fairly similar to nominees A, from the first Trump administration, and B, from any typical Republican administration. The second question that I would raise, and Rob alluded to it earlier, is will potential nominees be subject to any kind of litmus test or loyalty oath? Will they have to say or telegraph very strongly that they would rule a certain way on certain issues? If you look at interviews of past Supreme Court and circuit nominees, they will often say that, look, during the vetting process, my thinking was probed, I was asked hypotheticals, I was asked about how I would rule on prior cases, Humphrey's executor, what have you. People should get that joke in this crowd. I was not really asked to kind of commit to any particular outcome or line of rulings. I do wonder whether that will change. The third question, and it has been alluded to by a number of panelists, including Mike, is how much of a role will diversity play? And I think Mike is very correct to point out that there was a lot of diversity in the Trump appointees. And I also agree with Professor Tobias. There was a tremendous amount of diversity, especially experiential diversity, in terms of the Biden nominees. But if we just think of diversity in terms of just sort of the crude sort of racial preferences-y way of racial and ethnic diversity, last time around, there was not a huge focus in the Trump administration on this. I wonder whether that could change. And the reason I ask that is because in this election, to its credit, the Trump presidential campaign made huge inroads into minority communities. And I think in the past, where maybe they would have thought, oh gosh, certain minority communities are kind of a lost cause electorally, I think that's no longer the case. And if they want to further cement their growing ties to various communities, minority communities, communities of color, whatever you might want to say, I do wonder whether perhaps there will be a little bit more of a focus. So, for example, And again, this was alluded to by Mike. Could appointing the first AAPI, I just came from the NAPABA conference. For your reference, AAPI is Asian American Pacific Islander, no longer acceptable. You're supposed to say, it's a mouthful, AANHPI, Asian American Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander judges. So, could it be helpful to the Trump administration to appoint the first AANHPI justice to the U.S. Supreme Court? And I do think it would be very interesting if you think about the knives out approach to nominations. It's, the Democrats have always paid much more attention to identity politics, which of course is the theme of this conference, than Republicans. Is it more politically difficult for them to vote against the first AANHPI justice? So I do think that that is an interesting question. And as Mike mentioned, some of the strongest Trump nominees, setting aside whether they're, you know, black, white, yellow, or purple, some of the strongest Trump appointees to the circuit courts have been Asian American. I actually have been planning to write about this for Original Jurisdiction. The working title of my piece is Crazy Right Asians. whether you're talking about judges Bumate or Ho or Lee or Park or Rao, let's put it this way, these judges are not squishes. I may be a squish. They're not squishes. And so I think that it could be very interesting to see what kind of Supreme Court nominees we get from the Trump administration. So now let me sort of offer a couple of brief comments on some of the remarks of my co-panelists. Sort of, I'm now verging into the intra-panel part of the discussion. I think one question that is interesting, and this has been discussed by the other panelists, is will there be any procedural or rule changes? There is that famous saying that civil procedure people like to say, like, you know, let me control the rules and, you know, I'll control the game or something like that. And I will say that the rules are hugely consequential. For example, I think that the demise of the filibuster for judicial nominees played a huge role in giving us nominees who I would personally submit are more extreme on both the right and the left, because instead of needing 60 or more votes, instead of needing some significant buy-in from the other side or the other party, now you can just have nominees squeak by on a party line vote. I think probably many people in this room and maybe many people up here think that's a good thing. I personally think it was not a good thing. I prefer nominees who, while they're, you know, conservative or progressive, I prefer them to at least have some sort of a buy-in from the other side. Another interesting question that was raised earlier is blue slips for district judges. And I actually wrote a piece for the Times arguing against blue slips for circuit judges before they were actually abolished. And in some ways, I think you could argue that the case for getting rid of blue slips is actually stronger for district judges, because here's the problem with blue slips. They slow down the process, they leave more judgeships unfilled, and at the district court, you're talking about serious judicial backlogs. There are a lot of seats that are so-called judicial emergencies, where the number of cases per district judge is just, you know, hundreds and hundreds higher than it should be. And blue slips are part of this, because if you have senators from one party and a White House of the other, often those seats are very difficult to fill. I think you could say, look, district court cases are less politicized. We just need people to, you know, process those Social Security cases or sentence those defendants or what have you. And so why should we be contributing to these backlogs by holding up these judges whose opinions are not going to really be that ideologically consequential? So I think that whether we should get rid of blue slips for district judges is an interesting question. Going to Mike's points, he pointed out that the Trump nominees were superbly credentialed, and he also mentioned a study by these two professors, Mitu Gulati and Stephen Choi, that I wrote about in my column for a Bloomberg Law, showing that the Trump judges, whether you measure in terms of their productivity, their influence, what have you, are really strong performers. I think the title of my piece was something like Trump Judges Are High-Performing Mavericks or something like that. And it was very interesting because when I interviewed them for my piece, they actually kind of went into this piece kind of, you know, they're both fairly liberal professors. They went in thinking, oh, like they're kind of rubbing their hands, like what data are we going to get to prove that these Trump judges are a bunch of like lazy partisan hacks? And then they found out to their surprise that Trump judges actually are more productive, more influential, and more judicially independent than the nominees of other administrations. And here I'm going to tie it into what the Trump administration in its first term was looking for in terms of selection. They were looking at former Supreme Court clerks. They were looking at judges, they were looking at thought leaders, they were looking at people who, as, say, Supreme Court clerks or circuit courts, have a lot of experience drafting opinions. These are people who are very intellectually engaged, and I think that's what you're looking for when you're looking for influential and important circuit judges. The Biden administration was focusing much more on, say, public defenders and interest group litigators at places like, say, the ACLU. And while I think that that is important in terms of having experiential diversity on the bench, the skill sets of, say, a public defender who may have a very busy caseload and is in the trial court and isn't really writing appellate briefs, those skill sets of the Biden nominees don't map onto the skill set of an appellate judge as well as, say, having been a Supreme Court clerk, having been a circuit court clerk, having a certain academic pedigree, et cetera. So I think it should not be surprising that Trump judges perform well under these measures when we look at the selection criteria. Going to Mike's point about intra-party defection, I just want to say something here. I don't know if any of you, how many of you follow this, but if you sort of Google this, I think that you can say many nice things about Senator Tim Scott, but I think his handling of the Ryan Bounds nomination for the Ninth Circuit was really, shall we say, disappointing. He voted for cloture on the nomination and then voted against the nominee on the floor. And first of all, I think that that was really unnecessary. But if you look at what happened to Ryan Bounds, and I wrote a Wall Street Journal piece about this, he had written some college editorials that were used against him, weaponized, as this process often happens to be. And these articles were very innocuous. They're milquetoast compared to what's said at the average Trump rally. And so I really do think that it was disappointing. If the administration has the opportunity to do so, I think that they should revisit the idea of nominating Ryan Bounds. Again, just Google it. There's some good pieces from the Wall Street Journal and the National Review on this. Another issue I will raise is Mike alluded to competing priorities. One thing we have to remember is the White House, the Senate, and the House are all going to be controlled by Republicans. So, in many ways, for folks in this room, this is good news. But it also means that there's going to be more of a possibility of, what, shocking, getting legislation through. And I think as a result, there is this competing priority. When you have divided government, you can't get anything passed in terms of legislation. And so you just kind of turn to, judges, like, time to make the donuts, like just kind of cranking out the judges. And I think you're going to have competing priorities here because you might actually be able to get some legislation out of a Senate that is going to have 53 Senate seats, a House that's going to be Republican, and the White House. I think that's pretty much all I have to say. I look forward to the rest of the discussion and, of course, your questions. Thank you.
Thank you, David. At risk of oversimplification, we've had the role of blue slips, intraparty defection, consultation between the White House and senators, judgeship bill, unpredictability, experiential and racial diversity, a lot of topics. Let's go through the panel in the same order, and for any commentary you have on the discussion offered by your co-panelists. Rob?
Sure. So David raised a lot of interesting questions. Really glad to have him here to raise those. On the prospective influence of the Federal Society moving forward, now I don't speak for President Trump or the transition team, but I am confident the quality of the judicial nominees coming out of Trump 47 will remain, and I lose no sleep over that issue. On diversity, the Supreme Court picks, the first two that I was there for, were made on the basis of their written work. And obviously, Trump did make a number of diverse circuit nominees, and a lot of them have produced a lot of great written work, so I'm sure it will be considered moving forward. It's true that Biden has appointed more ethnically diverse circuit judges than Trump, but I am not convinced he's appointed that many more ethnically diverse district judges. And of course, the senators have the thumb on the scale there, so maybe we should look more to the Senate on that issue than the White House. Finally, on Professor Tobias's point about judges' bill, I hope it passes. We probably all hope it passes. Jim Jordan, chair of the House Judiciary Committee, said he supports it. We've got something out of the House. We've got chairman of the party in charge in the House. But ranking member Nadler, a Democrat, says he's not sure he supports it. So I hope everyone can come together and appoint more, you know, allow for more judges. You know, given that we are in the lame duck, there's no real political downside for President Biden to sign this. It becomes increasingly hard to get bipartisan legislation. So, you know, this might be something he could take some pride in on his way out the door.
Mike?
Thank you. Thanks, everyone. This has been a great panel, very insightful. Start towards the end. I mean, I think Ryan Bounds would have been a tremendous circuit judge, and I think the country would be lucky to get him for something in this administration. I agree with you completely there. I think David was absolutely right about the relative skill sets and how that probably relates to the relative productivity and influence. I've been sort of waiting for someone to sort of put it that succinctly, and I think that's spot on. I disagree with David on the filibuster. I think that the filibuster for the executive calendar is an ahistorical innovation of Chuck Schumer, Larry Tribe, and Cass Sunstein, starting around 2001 when George Bush became president. If you look at it historically, judicial nominees and the executive calendar generally were almost never subject to filibuster on ideological grounds before the Bush administration. And so it was an ahistorical innovation. They did it to us in the Bush years. McConnell then did it to them in the Obama years. It went away. McConnell told them they'd regret it. I think they do. We are where we are now, and I think that's probably fine. As to David's point on diversity and Trump's inroads into various minority communities, including the Hispanic community, I think that's an interesting point. I mean, that's not really my side of the shop, but my sense is that he made inroads into these communities because of his policies and because members of these communities believe that President Trump and hopefully increasingly the Republican Party are looking out for their political interest. And so I think that's in spite of the sort of self-professed political leaders of these various groups, who tend to be the ones who are more interested in sort of diversity counting in places like the judiciary. And so I think if I'm correct in that, say, Hispanic voters voted for Trump because they like his policies, he should probably continue his policies from last time in terms of picking excellent conservative originalist judges who will apply the rule of law. As to the Federalist Society's role, I mean, I've been fortunate to do a bunch of very interesting things in my career that hopefully have had a bit of a positive effect on where the judiciary has been. What I like to say is the Federalist Society did that. I don't mean that in the Sheldon Whitehouse way. I mean that at every single role that I have had, I've been completely surrounded by Federalist Society lawyers. They're everywhere at every level and over the last 10 years that I've been doing this, of Congress, the administration, and these are the people you need to actually get these things done. And so I think I agree completely with David that that's the supply. And if you want to get it done, you have to go to that well. To Professor Tobias's comments, I think we'll see what happens in the lame duck. It is hard to get things done in the lame duck. It is harder than it may seem. Members don't want to be there on either side. Nobody really knows whose members don't want to be there. So it's very much a fog of war for everybody. We're going to have to do the defense authorization. We're going to have to fund the government. We're probably going to have to do some sort of disaster relief. There's going to be a lot of other competing priorities on the floor. And just because it's a lame duck doesn't necessarily mean that Democratic members aren't going to want to go home on weekends. And so I think we'll see what happens there. I agree on the judges bill. Senator McConnell supported it. As you say, it got out by unanimous consent in the Senate. Hopefully the House takes it up. And as to both Professor Tobias and Rob mentioned, you know, senior eligible judges, we'll see what happens to them. The thing I have found with judges is they don't like to be told what to do. One of the really neat things about my time at the Office of Legal Policy is I was in one of the very few positions where I could tell judges what to do when I was helping them in their process, and they had to listen to me. They didn't really have much of a choice. Outside of that context, doesn't really work. They don't really like it. We'll see what they do, but it's going to be up to all of them, and they're going to have to make their decisions in their good time. Last point to Rob. I typed it down. The biggest open question is the maintenance of the blue slips for districts. It's not an open question. They're staying.
Professor Tobias.
Well, I beg to differ on the district blue slips. I think there are reasons for district blue slips, and there are at least three. One is most district judges are nominated and confirmed for their competence, is my perception. They can move the cases, and I think that's critically important. Secondly, I think Lindsey Graham's point is if you lose this, the home state senators are responsible for, and it's their prerogative to recommend those people to the White House. And if it turns out that they are not competent, then they're going to be blamed. And I don't defend Sheldon Whitehouse necessarily, but I think he's made the same point, is I don't want in my home state, Rhode Island, somebody from the West Coast or, you know, from the heartland or wherever. And then finally, I would say, as to the district blue slips, that those judges make the record. And so I wouldn't diminish them in any way. And that's critical, because that's what appellate judges see as the material from which they must then carve out final decisions in 99% of the cases.
David, your second bite at the apple here, commenting on
Yeah, so I don't really have actually much to add. On the blue slips, I should say, I was just kind of floating that. I actually don't really have particularly strong views, and I think my fellow panelists make some good points about why they should remain and why they will remain. I will point out one thing on the whole issue of demographics. In general, those of you who read me know I'm very, very opposed to racial preferences, especially in things like higher education. But I do think judgeships are different in the sense that considerations beyond just pure, quote-unquote, merit have always been involved. And I will point out one example that I think might resonate for this audience. You know, it has been reported and written in history books and whatnot that one of the reasons that President Reagan was drawn to the appointment of Justice Scalia, who really is one of the all-time great justices, was to cement or strengthen ties to the Italian-American community. So I don't think it is illegitimate to make these considerations. I wasn't a fan of what, say, President Biden did in sort of very upfront saying for the seat that went to Justice Jackson, basically it's reserved only for a black woman. But I don't think it's inappropriate for considerations like strengthening ties to a particular community to come into play when picking judges. And then on the judgeships bill, I think I agree with everyone else that I support it. I think Rob and Professor Tobias and Mike would know this better. The new judgeships that are created, these are the ones that are going to be staggered, right? Like, so it's interesting. You know, one reason why President Carter appointed so many judges, including some real doozies on the Ninth Circuit, is you know, he got a whole new bunch of new judgeships, and they just kind of like, you know, like manna from heaven. They just kind of fell into his lap. This bill spreads out the new judges over a period of years. So I think both sides can feel a little bit better. It's not like the Democrats will say, oh my gosh, we're giving Trump a gazillion new judges. Depending on who controls the White House and the Senate, some of those future positions might be filled by Democratic presidents or senators. And so I think that this bill does deserve bipartisan support. And then finally, I just want to kind of talk about this notion that was mentioned of judges saying they're going to retire and then rescinding it. I think this is, you know, whether or not it's, I don't know that there's anything formally barring this, but I think this is not cool. I wrote a piece about this for the Wall Street Journal with Lori Lin, where we were talking about what we viewed as the inappropriateness of judges trying to influence the picking of their successors, where they essentially tell the White House, I'm looking forward to my retirement, especially if you pick, you know, so-and-so. I like the title that the Wall Street Journal copy desk picked for our piece, which is federal courts are not royal ones. These judgeships are not some kind of property that a judge gets to bequeath to a former clerk or some other person they favor. I think that my personal preference would be for judges to say either I'm retiring effective immediately, or I'm retiring by a date certain, rather than to play this gamesmanship. And I would point out that some of this gamesmanship happened in the Biden administration, where you had, for example, a judge in upstate New York who said, "Oh, I'm going senior," and then they nominated somebody he didn't like, and then he said, "Oh, change my mind." And again, I don't think it's appropriate. Judges are not supposed to be, according to the canons of ethics, involved in things that are of a more political nature. And I do think that the selection of judges is something that's consigned to the political branches, to the president, with the advice and consent of the Senate. I don't think it's appropriate for judges to be gaming their retirements. And look, I have no problem with a judge saying, "Well, I want to retire under a president of this or that party." Fine. But to actually be so targeted and, quite frankly, manipulative, I don't think that that's appropriate.
Well, before we bring you into this conversation, I just want to introduce one other topic for anyone's discussion. We've talked about a variety of different criteria: competence, pure legal talent, experiential diversity, racial diversity. I want to talk about the topic of judicial courage. What a judge does in this particular role, Article III judge, either to self-abnegate from personal policy preferences for purposes of ruling, or, frankly, within all the bounds of collegiality, at the same time being able to read the law a certain way and wanting to stand up for that. Anyone have any comments on that as a criterion for judicial selection?
Sure. I've said some of this before, and you've all probably heard it, but you know, Justice Thomas was our office's model for judicial courage. I have every reason to believe that will remain the same moving forward. You cannot care what people think about your decisions. That's the way it has to go, and you know, Mike knows this from our interviews. We asked a lot of questions about this. You know, these are tough jobs. You undergo a lot of scrutiny once you're out in the world. We've seen increasing amounts of scrutiny on candidates' families, their relationships, their kids. It's very invasive and disruptive, but you know, that's what we're dealing with. And so we wanted to make sure that people knew what they were in for, and I'm very proud of the work that so many of them have delivered. But it's very important. You cannot be concerned with how the public will perceive your work. You just have to be confident in yourself and in your closest relationships and take it from there. And I think it's a very good standard to have moving forward.
And look, it's not just sort of reputational courage at this point. A guy was indicted not long ago for trying to kidnap and assassinate Judge Cannon and her family because of her decisions down on the Southern District of Florida in the Trump case. So it is courage across the board that we need from our judges. I think people are right to look for it. I think it's something that you can try to look for, as we did by asking them questions about it. You also see it in their background. You see about sort of something I sort of got into a bit in my remarks, the kinds of jobs they've taken that have shown this kind of courage in the past, people who are willing to, for the sake of the rule of law, conservative principles, or on the other side, progressive principles, put your career in a place where you're willing to fight for these things, even if there's some sort of reputational or, unfortunately, in some cases, more personal consequence. So I think it's very important.
Yeah. Oh, go ahead.
Well, I think one issue we can all agree on is judicial security. And there needs to be more of it and more targeted, because I can't think of anything more reprehensible than that, that threat.
I totally agree with Professor Tobias. Judges have already made financial sacrifices, for example, sacrifices in their privacy, et cetera, to serve the public in this way, and I think we need to do whatever we can to protect them. And again, just to sort of echo, not to make this too much of sort of like a preaching to the choir, what have you, but I think courage is such an important quality for a judge. I would be a terrible judge. I want people to like me. That's kind of why I quit Above the Law 5 years ago. Everybody was hating me. Now I write nice things. People like me. I get invited to parties. I would be a terrible judge. So I think that you need to be willing to have people even hate you. And I will point out, shameless plug for another project of mine, in addition to my Substack newsletter, I have a podcast. And in the podcast, I've interviewed a number of judges, including some wonderful Federalist Society stalwarts. And two of my most recent judicial interviews, one was with Judge Kenley of the Ninth Circuit, one was with Judge Rakoff of the Southern District, who is a pretty, I think even he would say, a pretty, pretty left-leaning judge. And when I asked both of them, what is the decision that you're most proud of, both of them cited decisions that they knew would be unpopular. Judge Rakoff mentioned his finding the federal death penalty unconstitutional. Judge Lee mentioned his decision regarding the Second Amendment and California's ban on large capacity magazines. And so I think that regardless of your political party or affiliation, regardless of your jurisprudential leanings or methodology, the ability to have courage and even to, yes, be hated is such an important part of being a judge, and why I would never want that job.
We're going to bring you into the conversation. I trust these comments have engendered some questions. Feel free to line up with the microphones. Three requirements. First, please give your name and affiliation. Second, if there's a particular speaker to whom you're addressing the question, try to mention that at the beginning of your question. Or if it's the entire panel, let us know that. And I will exercise moderator prerogative that if you give a long preface, we need to move from a declarative sentence to an interrogative sentence at some point. We'll begin with Ed Whalen.
The Policy Center is on. I have two questions, one disguised in the form of a comment. my first question is for Rob Luther, who I believe said that it's important that President-elect Trump's judicial nominees share his worldview. I guess I'm a little puzzled as to just what that means or how expansive it is. And, I would think that a commitment to conservative legal principles ought to be enough, but I'm interested in hearing why that's not so. And then on the blue slip, I think it's important to understand why the blue slip arose in the first place in order to assess whether it will persist. So you have all sorts of good government reasons about why it should or shouldn't exist. I sum it up as the blue slip exists because there is a bipartisan consensus that no senator should have his corruption trial presided over by his political enemy. And I think that that consensus will persist. Thank you.
I mean, as to that second point, after the Menendez hung jury, it got reassigned to a judge who was from the Hudson County political machine of Bob Menendez, and the Department of Justice dropped the trial, dropped the charges. So there are concrete examples of that, Ed.
And then they had to go to the Southern District of New York to, get that crook. Anyway, I'm from New Jersey. Go ahead, Rob.
Rob. Sure. I mean, on worldview, I think we know the issues that are important to President Trump. He's been talking about them nonstop for the last 4 years. As I mentioned, immigration. You be tough on immigration. That doesn't mean that you can't ever, vacate an immigration judge's decision or that you have to keep send every person back. But, will you be tough on immigration? Are you engaged in this issue? I think criminal justice is a similar topic, right? I mean, President Trump has taken a very strong pro-law enforcement perspective. Are you the kind of person that's going to look at a case with the presumption that, convicted defendant, probably was unjustly convicted, or are you going to, take a more law enforcement friendly worldview? Now, again, you have to, of course, apply existing precedent, but, we all have, priors, and I think that's why we have people with different judicial philosophies, and presidents of different parties choose different people. I don't think Trump has been particularly vague about the kinds of qualities he's looking for in his nominees or people to be around him. Obviously, some people might disagree.
Further questions? Microphones are open. I'm sure we don't have univocal views on this. Professor Lawson.
Hi, Gary Lawson, University of Florida, Levin College of Law, and a certifiable academic crackpot. So here's an academic crackpot question. Put aside the judges' bill for a moment, district judges. There's a whole other group of people called judges who aren't. And if there are any administrative law judges here, I apologize for this, but they, you, are hearing examiners, right? Their constitutional status, at least those who don't just do benefits claims, is right now in serious question. One simple way to cure the constitutional defect is to make them Article III judges, which maybe they should be anyway. Is there the slightest chance that you could do the same thing with them that the judges' bill does with district judges? Double whammy, solve a constitutional problem, and create more vacancies at the same time.
Mike?
I mean, we're obviously paying attention to the constitutional status of AL purported J's. but that is not a solution that I've really seen much of. We'll periodically get outreach to convert other non-Article III judgeships into Article III judgeships, and they don't really go anywhere. I think as a general matter, because these lifetime appointments are so important and so politically valuable to both sides, it's very hard to do anything in this space when it comes to expanding the number. So even the judge bill, Senator Young has been working on that for 10 years now. They came up with very complicated formulas that David was pointing out in terms of different tranches over time that relate to different states over time. That has been tough enough that I don't see anything there happening.
Fair.
Others?
One thing I would add is I do think that Professor Lawson's concern is very well placed, and I think we will see continued attention to this, perhaps in terms of litigation. I believe I saw Chief Judge Elrod earlier. She authored the opinion in Jarkissi in the Fifth Circuit case that was affirmed by the U.S. Supreme Court, basically kind of putting the brakes on the Securities and Exchange Commission's in-house judging tribunals, what have you, if you're going to have these significant penalties visited upon people. And I think, again, everyone focused on Loper-Bright and Relentless and the overruling of Chevron. But I think Jarkissi and Corner Post, it's kind of a three-legged stool of these very important decisions from last term that take a stand against overreach by the administrative state. And I know that there are some impact litigators out there, some constitutional litigators. I'm sure you're cooking up some good cases to try and enforce these principles.
Along those lines, I would recommend to the audience a recent concurrence by my predecessor in my current job, Andrew Ferguson, on the FTC about the ALJs at the FTC and their constitutionality, basically explaining what's coming here in no uncertain terms. I think he's right, and I think people need to be prepared for it.
Ben Isger, Southeastern Legal Foundation. Thank you for giving this talk. I had a question about specific areas and sort of regional differences in cases that are brought. Obviously, there are a few district court judges who have a bit of an outsized impact in some areas. Judge Kaczmarek's one outstanding example, but there are a number. How much does that play into selection? If you might be picking a circuit where there are a lot of, like the Ninth Circuit in immigration cases, for instance, or environmental cases there, or another circuit, how much does that play into conversations inside the room and that sort of thing? Thank you.
I think it does, and I think it ought to, and I think that's probably one of the arguments, especially at the district court, for the blue slip, in that the senators are the ones who, if they're doing their job right, know better than most what the particular challenges faced by their local courts are, what the kinds of cases are, what the kinds of crime may be. And through that check, they're able to assert themselves productively in ways to actually see the needs of their local community met.
Yeah, I like Mike's answer on that, except he uses the word check and I use the word veto, on the blue slip. There's obviously an incentive to work with the senators on court, from the White House perspective. You need their vote, 51 votes. It's not as if the blue slip went away, you wouldn't negotiate with senators anymore. Of course you would. In fact, I think the negotiations would be much more productive because you'd have to have them. The difference is, at the end of the day, the senators wouldn't be able to block seats, keep them open the way that so many Democrat senators did under the Trump administration. We attempted very hard to negotiate with New Jersey senators, Massachusetts senators, the Washington state senators. No deals to be made, no one for one, no two for one, nothing. So guess what? Trump left office filling zero of the, I think it had ballooned to like eight vacancies in New Jersey. As soon as Biden came in, boom, slate of New Jersey judges. Same thing in California. God, there's so many judgeships in California. Same thing. Dozens. I think there's been two dozen Biden's made. So, you know, if people think, you know, justice is better served that way, I have to question that.
I'm in favor of keeping seats open when necessary.
Hi, Jordan Lawrence from Alliance of Ending Freedom. So I'm assuming, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that there is extensive background checks before somebody is formally nominated by the president. And I'm just curious what that looks like and what are the kinds of reasons why somebody doesn't get a nomination? Is it just ideology? Is it, you know, bad things in their past? Talk about that.
Aside, it seems like there's two questions. Background question, why doesn't somebody get the nomination? I mean, people don't get the nomination, not the best person interviewed, or if the senators won't support it, or some sort of insurmountable obstacle will keep them from being confirmed. We placed a heavy emphasis on written record, interview, recommendations, the informal checks by talking to people in the community that we knew, counsel's office, 20 fairly experienced folks with broad range geographic, time clerking different places, practicing different places, going to different schools. You know, we start with our informal network and work from there. And of course, you know, this network that we have with, you know, the hundreds of us was, you know, integral in that process, obviously, as well documented. As to background problems, I'm not going to probably get into specifics on that other than to say, you know, things that could pose risk or liability to the administration and frankly make that potential nominee's life much worse, especially if they weren't confirmed.
One thing I will add for the younger folks you're a very youthful looking audience, but for the younger folks in the audience, I would say watch your social media. I have decried this, holding people accountable for things they wrote or said, certainly before they went to law school. But I would say even during law school, I think these should be times of experimentation and, you know, exploring different ideas. And I don't think your judicial nomination should be torpedoed based on something that you wrote like literally 20 years ago before you even went to law school. But the reality of it is both sides will seize upon what they can find in your past. And so I love social media. Connect with me on LinkedIn, follow me on Instagram, Twitter, X, whatever. I love social media, but I'm not trying to become a judge. And I think for those of you who are, I'm not saying don't do social media, but just be cognizant of the possible trade-offs for your career down the road. I don't want this to become some kind of trap for the unwary, where you sort of say, wow, I realized kind of later, oh, I really would love to engage in judicial service, but ooh, I wrote some stuff back in my 20s that I'm not proud of. Just be cognizant of that.
The old line, don't say it unless you want it on the front page of the Washington Post. Don't tweet it unless you want it on a giant demonstrative behind Amy Klobuchar.
Hi, my name is Josh Nye. I'm an attorney from a flyover state. I wanted to ask about the conversation regarding experiential diversity as far as the type of practice, but if the panel could comment on whether there has been any, especially with kind of the populist J.D. Vance type campaign that was run, especially with his upbringing, his proud upbringing from Appalachia, whether you think there may be a movement towards experiential diversity from a Federalist standpoint, specifically looking at state Supreme Court justices or, with federal judges saying, I'm not going to hire law clerks from certain Ivy League schools, whether regional schools or other type flyover concerns may have kind of a comeback. Because someone told me last week that I believe the last state Supreme Court justice that was appointed to SCOTUS was under Eisenhower. I'm a Kansan, President Eisenhower. I don't know if that's true, but can you comment on that?
Two quick points on that. I think that's a very interesting point. One on elevating state Supreme Court justices. I think there's been a practical hesitancy there for a number of years because the common law role of most state Supreme Court justices is very different in terms of their powers than the federal role on the federal Supreme Court, where we have a constitution of enumerated powers. So I think, frankly, it's going back to the Eisenhower years where these state Supreme Court justices felt that they could just do whatever they wanted. We don't want that. Secondly, in terms of getting people from different schools, I think if you go back and look at the Trump circuit judges in particular, you will see that a lot more of them went to, went to Yale, went to Harvard and went to other Ivy League schools, but a lot of them did not go to your Yale, Harvard, Stanford sort of block of hyper elite prestige. You have a lot of people who went to other schools, Kansas, Notre Dame, Florida, and they have that diversity from educational experience, but then what they also tend to have in common, they did extremely well in those schools. I think that was a really good thing in terms of finding the right kind of people, and I hope that if they did that again this time, it would be great.
I would say that I think being a state judge, I understand the concerns Mike raises, but I think there are some excellent, excellent Trump appointees who previously served on state courts. I believe I saw Judge Branch earlier from the 11th Circuit. I think that you get to see how they were as a judge, and if they had a fidelity to the law as a state judge or a federal judge who was maybe a magistrate or bankruptcy or what have you judge, I think that can be very useful, but I do understand Mike's concern. On the issue of diversity of background, even though guilty as charged, I went to Yale Law School, maybe because I've met so many unimpressive people from Yale Law School. I actually am all in favor of hiring from a broader range of schools. Those of you who are judges, I think really, I know it's just kind of easier to just whatever go on, what's the thing called?
Oscar,
and just basically be like filter like top X schools. But there are some great, great clerks who come from such a wide range of schools. And I would just point you, I track on original jurisdiction Supreme Court clerk hiring, and Justice Thomas has been great at hiring from a broad range of schools. And I think if you look at the accomplishments and influence of his clerk alumni network, you could argue that it's like second to none. And so I think hiring from a broad range of schools has worked out very nicely for Justice Thomas. And it takes more work rather than just calling up your favorite professor at Harvard and telling me, like, who do you got? But, I think there can really be some great rewards for you and your chambers if you explore clerks from different backgrounds.
I apologize. We're not going to be able to get to the last question. Very good. One brief announcement before we wrap up. As you get time between panels, we encourage you to visit the Remnant Trust's Rare Documents exhibit. The exhibit's in the Cardozo Room on the terrace level and open all throughout the convention, so please stop by and see what they brought this year. Please join me in thanking this tremendous panel.